Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I'm delighted to welcome Yoshi Wada to the podcast. Yoshi is a professor at the Division of Biological and Environmental Science and Engineering at KAUST, King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia. He started this position a couple of years ago, and then prior to that, Yoshi was director of YASA's Biodiversity and Natural Resources Program, where he led strategic science development at the BNR program, managing more than 100 staff. Yoshi has received many awards, and the most prestigious is probably the AGU McIlwainy Medal. He is very famous in hydrology and is very well known for his early work on global hydrologic modeling that emphasizes global groundwater depletion, irrigation, and linkages to food production. Since arriving at KAUST, his research has expanded to integrated assessments of hydrology, climate, and incorporating social and economic aspects to provide a comprehensive assessment of current and future state of water, food, energy, and ecosystem security. And today we're going to focus on Saudi Arabia. I'm very interested to learn about the situation there and all of the things that are going on. So thank you so much, Yoshi, for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Bridget. Very nice to be here.
So, Yoshi, we're very keen to learn about Saudi Arabia, and we all think of it as sort of a big desert. I guess it's termed Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And maybe you can give us some background on that, the population, the physiography and things like that, so that the listeners can get some context for the water issues.
Yes. So Saudi Arabia is a very big country. And population growth is currently very rapid. And average age of the country is around 28. So it's very young society. And for the environment, it's very dry countries. And climate is hyper-arid to arid. So it's one of the driest regions in the world. And currently, country is focusing on economic diversifications and trying to change the economic structure from oil-dependent economy to more diverse. An economy including manufacturers and also renewable energies and a different type of IT service and the financial sector. So, yeah, a lot of things happening in Saudi Arabia, and it's quite a diverse demography. So 1/3 of the population is labor migrant from the neighboring country, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and some African countries. And 2/3 are the Saudi national. And there's also a lot of expats, like myself, that are living in the Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, so it's very international, actually, society.
Right. Thanks, Yoshi. So, yeah, Saudi Arabia, it's very large, as you say, 2 million square kilometers. And then it has access to coastlines on the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, which I think helps with the water issues. And the topography then, I guess, ranges from mountains in the west to the desert plains towards the east and north. And neighboring countries are Jordan, Iraq, and Oman and Yemen and UAE. And so very interesting situation. And you mentioned the population, I guess, is about 32 million, and the median age is about 28. So a pretty young population, and population growing rapidly. So very interesting situation, very water scarce. Climate is, as you said, hyper arid to arid, maybe 50 to 150, 200 millimeters per year max. So it's amazing to have so many people living in such a dry country. And I think it makes me think that Steve Borelick said many years ago that maybe you can make up for lack of water with excess energy. And so if you have enough energy, then you can desalinate seawater, treat wastewater, do lots of different things to try to address that shortage. So since joining KAUST, then your research has expanded. Your PhD and your early research focused on global hydrologic modeling from Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And now you're expanding that to consider food security, energy security. And you have a pretty large team, including economists and others. Maybe you can describe a little bit about the work that you are doing.
I actually studied economics in my undergraduate. Then the also moving towards political economies and political science. Then my master, I did two master, one in environmental science. Then later I switched to hydrologies, and that's where I did my PhD in the Netherlands. And then I went to NASA working for satellite observations and data simulations and global modelings. Then I would say last several years, I have been focusing on the system science. So system science is that science that one discipline cannot find the solutions or cannot find an approach to fix because of the complex issues. As you imagine that Saudi Arabia with such a rapid population growth and economic diversification with quite a harsh environment and climate, the challenge is quite complex and very large. So my team, when I came to KAUST, idea is that to establish a team that actually can tackle the issue from a very interdisciplinary, multi-plural disciplines. So my own background in hydrologies, environment, in addition to those, I added macroeconomy and also energy security, food and crop agriculture areas. And also Saudi Arabia is very dry countries, but also there's quite some ecosystem ecology that also present in the country. So my team also dealing with ecosystem and biodiversity in the countries. So we trying to find those several key together and find some basically integrated framework so that if the country is investing into a lot of big infrastructure, so you can imagine Dubai, and Dubai invested a lot for the large infrastructure. Saudi Arabia is following similar paths right now. Then we have to analyze, so whether there's enough financial resources, what's the impact on the environment, whether there's enough water resources, and how much food that we have to import. Later on, we will discuss about a new city. It's called NEOM. And NEOM is planning to have 9 million people in the future. And how to actually support those ecosystems, we have to have a very complex matrix, which my team is aiming to provide. So, and we need to provide a very good narrative and scenarios so that we can support a policymaker in Saudi Arabia. Many ministries or science tend to be still siloed, very disciplinary based. So basically my team tried to tackle those challenges and provide a more holistic view how the solution can be more efficient with limited resources.
Right. I think that's fascinating, Yoshi. And even in your early work, you were linking water and food production through irrigation. And whenever we make these decisions and however we move forward, there are always trade-offs. And oftentimes we don't acknowledge those trade-offs. I mean, if I'm getting on a plane and going down the gangway, they talk about they're going to have sustainable aviation fuel, and they have contracts with the Midwest and the U.S. for corn production. So it may be sustainable from the energy perspective, but what about the irrigation and the water requirements and stuff? So I think it's really nice that your team then includes so many different disciplines that you can go across the sectors to address the trade-offs in any decision. And then if you're okay with that, then that's good. But many people ignore them and just are, as you said, siloed. You mentioned the new city of NEOM, which I think is fascinating. And I looked it up last night on Google Maps, so it shows up. And I know it's in the early stages of development. It's close to the Red Sea, and it seems to extend over a long distance. You mentioned where we talked previously that there's going to be a port and the airport and all of these different things. But so it seemed to extend mainly from maybe Aqaba in Jordan, I mean, near that region to the south. Maybe you can describe a little bit about it and the vision for NEOM?
Yes, it's a very unique concept, and it's actually a straight line. It's called a line, which is going to be 170 kilometers. And this is basically as long as from east to west in Italy. Then this 170 kilometer length, then the building. So they're going to be two buildings side by side, and height will be 500 meters. So these two buildings side by side continuing for 170 kilometers, this is where those 9 million people are going to be located in the regions. And this is actually only one that happening, but there are several others in the NEOM. So there's also a very big port. It's called Oxagon. It's also constructed. Let's see, it's quite part of a major transport shipment path in the world. So Saudi Arabia is also aiming to have a larger influence on the shipment and the transport sector. Then Oxagon is trying to accommodate those economy and for the shipment. And we have also the Toroyana. It's in the mountain areas of the NEOM, where that the Asian Winter Olympic will be hosted in the future. And so it's going to be a combination we call Giga Project in the NEOM. It's in the Gulf of Aqaba, bordering to the Jordan, as you mentioned, Bridget. So it's quite a large areas that we are looking at, and 9 million people, and we have to supply energy, and it's going to be all renewable for supplying energy. And the water will be mostly supplied by desalinations. And then in order to achieve that, we need to build a large infrastructure. So currently, if you look at the Google Earth engine, you can see the 170 kilometer path, the foundations in the satellite image. So it's been ongoing.
Right. Yeah, it's. I mean, as you mentioned earlier on, Saudi Arabia is trying to move beyond their fossil fuel economy and then to expand and consider. So NEOM is supposed to have a circular economy with the zero carbon and totally reliant on renewable energy and promoting sustainability. And I think it's hilarious that the Winter Olympics in 2034 will be hosted there. And it just makes you realize what you can do with a lot of energy. You can make up for water shortages. You can create artificial snow. But you do have mountains near there. And so that's going to be very interesting. So moving back to talking about water resources, and we'll be talking about NEOM quite a bit, I think, in different aspects. So you mentioned arid, semi-arid, hyper-arid, low precipitation, low relative humidity, maybe 30%, and very high temperatures. And it seems Saudi Arabia is mostly reliant on groundwater resources, and much of those are fossil groundwater, so recharged thousands of years ago, and so basically mining the groundwater. So maybe you can describe that a little, Yoshi.
Yes. So right now, temperature is about 40 degrees in Jeddah. And if you go to the Riyadh, that's the middle of the Saudi Arabia, temperature goes up to 47, 48 right now. So now it's the hottest time. And you can imagine that with very limited rainfall, there's a large evaporations that are also happening. And it's very challenging area for the agriculture. But if you look at the history of the Saudi Arabia, agriculture is actually one of the key sectors that are producing the food, mainly wheat, livestock feed like alfalfa, clover, and also vegetable and the fruits. And we're going to talk about it later, but the Saudi Arabia was used to be one of the largest wheat exporter in the world. And then we think about it, where the water comes from. And it's all come from the fossil groundwaters. And if you look at the satellite image for Saudi Arabia in the central area, there's a lot of center pivot irrigations. Basically, we're extracting water from currently go up to a few hundred meters in the aquifer because we already extracted a lot of fossil groundwater already. So that's not the exact estimate, but one estimate from NASA saying that the 80-90% of the fossil groundwater is already depleted in Saudi Arabia. So we have only 10-20% left. And we still need to produce a lot of agriculture, which is using about 80% of our national water consumption. And there's no recharge almost in those aquifers. So it's very challenging areas, but the demand is going up as population is also growing.
Right. And thank you for sharing the paper by Salim Mohammed Awad on groundwater. I thought it was very interesting and describing the different aquifers, Umm Raduma, which is a karstified system, and the shallower system, Dammam Aquifer. These are considered mega aquifers, but with limited outcrop areas. So recharge is pretty low, localized in wadis and when you have extreme runoff. But it was interesting for me to read about in that paper, they were emphasizing the importance of climate change and how it would impact groundwater. Well, that groundwater was recharged thousands of years ago, most of it. So I don't think climate change is going to impact the supply of groundwater. But as you mentioned, it will affect the demand for water, and bigger issues may be the explosive population growth in Saudi Arabia. And so demand for water, and then the importance of food security for the country. I mean, since coming out of COVID, I think all of these countries are recognizing that they need to have food security. And so, although it seems crazy that they were exporting wheat, but having some food security would be very valuable. And I was looking at some of the trade data, Yoshi, from a website, and 40 billion in imports, and about half of that, maybe $17 or $18 billion a year in 2022, were agricultural products. But it seemed like you have a pretty dispersed among many different countries, $2.5 billion from Brazil, US, Australia, and India. So maybe from that perspective, having it coming from many different countries, maybe that helps to make it more resilient. So it's the water, the food, water and food security, and all, of course, tied to energy. It's a delicate balancing game, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And so there's a lot of efforts securing stable food productions, and while that meeting the demand for those growing populations. And water resources is very scarce, so that the country do need to rely on the import of the food. And one big event that happened recently was related to Ukraine and Russia. So a lot of people know about the Middle East was relying on quite a lot of light cereal from those two countries. Then the obviously import was almost stopped. Then a lot of people had to find other sources. And a big issue that time was that the country didn't have any food reserve. So if you think about if there's those geopolitical event or climate shocks, then there's hardly no storage to absorb that type of shocks. So now that Saudi Arabia is actually also investing into food reserve for the wheat and some major cereal, that's also one effort that they're trying to improve the food security. And also that balancing out the food import and the production in the countries and water use for agriculture is actually decreasing quite rapidly for Saudi Arabia. If you compare the figures 10 years ago and now, water consumption of the agriculture is coming down 30-40% lower. And so that's mainly coming from reduction in the water consumption for the wheat and also livestock feed, alfalfa and the clover. So those are quite the big reductions in the agriculture production and shifting towards more hybrid crops, fruits and vegetables and some new technologies like vertical farming, hydroponics. That's also going to support the food production. So here that the improving food security is a real challenge. We have to do it like that. There's no very long time windows. And it's very much dependent on that technology.
Right. That's fascinating. Hadn't realized about food reserves and food storage, but it makes sense every time. If supply cannot meet demand, if we have a drought, then we store water in reservoirs or in aquifers and things to get through those lean times. So it makes sense to be storing food also. So I was recently talking with Maisoon Alzoubi from Jordan, and you shared the DCDISI aquifer between Jordan and Saudi Arabia. So good agreement there between the two countries. But it's interesting on the Saudi side, there are a lot of center pivot irrigation systems, so supporting irrigated agriculture there. And then you mentioned you're heavily reliant on imports. And I know recently there's so much discussion these days about the Colorado River, and there was concerns about exporting alfalfa from Arizona, in the lower Colorado, to Saudi Arabia. So I think the current governor has tried to stop some of that in one of the big farms there. But then you also bring up the importance of technology. And so I think greenhouse farming and vertical farming are fascinating, and they can recycle a lot of water and nutrients and make it more efficient. And so I was just reading about in Neom, in the city Neom, that they're enlisting the help of the Dutch greenhouse company to grow crops in the desert. And I thought that was fascinating. I mean, the Netherlands is a really small country, but it's about the second larger exporter of food globally. And a lot of it is attributed to vertical farming. So I don't know if you've done much work on that aspect or familiar with what they're discussing there, Yoshi.
Yes, indeed, Netherlands is one of the largest exporters of agriculture products in Europe. And they also heavily investing into the technologies, and Saudi Arabia, especially the NEOM, also doing this vertical farming. And in general, we call controlled environment agriculture. And so we control water use and also UVs and also the structure of the farming systems in the buildings. And we can also control CO2 in the buildings to enhance the growth of the crops. And here, mainly we're looking at high-value crops. So like vegetables, like tomato, cucumbers, and eggplants, and also the fruits. Recently, Saudi Arabia announced that the grapes, we are 100% self-sufficient. And the people know that dates are very popular here. And the dates obviously are 100% self-sufficient, but we also producing quite some other fruits, grapes. And tomato is also exporting as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tomatoes that come from those vertical, not the vertical farming yet, but the greenhouse that in the controlled agriculture.
Right. I mean, not that you can control things, but does it really make sense for Saudi Arabia to be exporting anything, considering the virtual water embodied in the food? And so basically you're exporting water and then you're subsidizing that a lot. And so it's interesting. But then you have the social aspect on those farmers and needing to make a living and stuff. And so it's a complex issue. So I just recently returned from Brazil from a conference there, and they're talking about they could produce more food for another billion people over the next 50 years. And so that would be great, because many countries will benefit from that, and especially in these semi-arid regions. So I think that would be important. So thinking about, I mean, the nice thing about greenhouses and stuff is that you can trade energy for food production, and you can optimize maybe water and greatly reduce the water use for irrigation because you're controlling the environment. And I hadn't really realized that you also try to control the CO2. And I guess that sometimes people talk about increasing CO2 and what impact that would have on food production and naturally in the future. But it's interesting that you're controlling that. And I guess you can recycle a lot of the nutrients, and so that would reduce pollution from those. And so from a water perspective, environment perspective, it maybe helps. But the trade-off then is the energy. And I guess with LED lighting, that has really been transformational in greenhouse production.
Yes, in fact, with LEDs and also CO2 controls and hydroponic farming, actually the yield of those crop increasing by 20 to 30%. So it's more productive in those environment. And we can also produce those vegetable fruits all year round.
Right. And I was seeing that they were also talking about perennial crops in some of those greenhouses. So it's amazing what you can do. And just to get back to storing the food to prepare for climate shocks or geopolitical shocks, is that being stored refrigerated, or have you built up much storage in Saudi Arabia? Or, I don't know, does China have large storages of food to get through? Are there data out there on how much food is being stored?
Yeah, well, this is a little bit related to national food security. It's national security. So there's not so much data, but we analyze World Bank, FAO data. And if we can calculate how much food is being produced and how much is consumed and also exported and imported, then you can potentially calculating sort of net difference. And there are some data on the food reserve. And if you look at the global food landscape, it's really only China that has a large food reserve that can absorb the large shocks in the food system for a few years. And many other countries, Europe, even US, Japan, don't really have a large food reserve. And Saudi Arabia is investing so that at least the major calories, like wheat and cereal, those crops can be stored for 1-2 years, then producing some urgent supplies in case that there's quite uncertain, like how the climate change maybe change agriculture productivity in those baskets, including Brazil and also still Russia and the Ukraine. There's quite uncertainty how those situations will change. So this is really probably needed solutions. And also, my perspective is that I think the country in the Middle East or Asia can also cooperate. So if there's a shock happens a few years ago, price is also went up. So if you look at the wheat price in the commodity market, went up more than 50% in 1 month. This has quite a large implications for food producers and the food consumers. And if you have the big reserve, you can absorb the price shocks. So my actually argument is that the country can also cooperate sort of emergency food reserve, not just one country, but for the several countries all together, so that you can accommodate those big shocks and also the potential price changes due to speculations or due to supply shock.
Right, right. I think if you can afford the higher prices in Saudi Arabia, but a lot of the developing countries may be more impacted because of those price shocks. And when they store these cereal reserves, do they need to refrigerate them? Is it refrigerated?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. And then you can just use it the next year and then replace that and keep up that reserve. So we talk about trying to get energy storage and things like that. So I guess the next aspect that we've been talking about, a trade-off between water and energy, and I was looking at the electricity production in 2022, mostly maybe 40% from oil and 60% from natural gas, and maybe renewables are gradually increasing. And there's Aqua Power, ACWA, I presume it's an acronym, is trying to achieve by 2030 renewable energy goal to provide 70% of the electricity from renewable energy. I may be incorrect in this, but so you can correct me. But I think you're trying to move in the direction then to increase renewable. And of course, you've got great solar potential and then also wind. So maybe you can describe that a little bit, Yoshi.
Yes. So Saudi Arabia is aiming for the net zero emission by 2060. Which is also same as in China. China is also aiming for net zero emission by 2060s, and Europe a little bit more ahead. They're aiming for 2040 or even 35. For Saudi Arabia, we have about, now it's 2024. So we have about 30 years to achieve this. And there are several pillars, only like currently very much dependent on the oil and the natural gas. but already heavily invested into solar and the wind. And obviously there's a large potential, but the issue for the solar wind is that it's not 24/7. Solar, sun goes down, and the wind also not always very stable producing the energy. So we also need to invest quite heavily on the battery as well, very good battery, so that we can store energy during the night. So we invest sort of large infrastructures, not just producing the energy side, but also storing energy, especially for those new city like NEOM. And another pillar is actually country currently considering, it's not yet finally decided, but country is also considering the nuclear power as well. So potentially planning to build the nuclear power plants for Saudi Arabia in the south, in addition to wind and the solar. And obviously there's also other consideration looking at the geothermal and some pump storage using big reservoirs. Then I think much later on, and the country also aiming to utilize hydrogen. Yeah, for the more like renewable economies and energy supply. So there are several major transformation that are happening, and the governance side has to be also implemented in a way that currently there is no policy and framework for hydrogen, for example. And we have to also work on the policy and the governance as well.
Right. Well, that's really fascinating. I mean, solar, that makes sense. So where is most of the wind energy generated? Is that a lot near the coast or
near the Red Sea? Yes.
Near the Red Sea. Yeah, right. And hydrogen is very interesting. And I was reading that in NEOM, there was almost more than an $8 billion investment in hydrogen. So basically, this is green hydrogen. So it's hydrogen made with renewable energy. And then you need water for the electrolysis. And so based on the stoichiometry, it's just 9 liters of water per kilogram of hydrogen. But then when you consider where is that water coming from, so it's going to come from desalination. If the desalination is 50% efficiency, so then that would double that water. And then you're going to be discharging concentrate to the Red Sea. So there are a lot of things that have to come together to make that happen. But what I was reading, and I think what you were talking to me the other day about, was that you already have offtake of the ammonia that they would generate to transport this hydrogen. So there are agreements then with Germany and Japan and other countries to take much of the hydrogen that they would generate. So it's very interesting.
Yes. In fact, Saudi Arabia took a major step in 2020 that shipped ammonia, about 40 tons, from Saudi Arabia to Japan. This was first transport of potential ammonia supply chains and future hydrogen supply chains. So Saudi Arabia is actually leading these sectors. And I guess advantage for Saudi Arabia is that hydrogen potential production is much cheaper compared to the other country. So there is a potential. And if you combine desalination capacities and hydrogen facility together, there's also efficiency gain that we can achieve. And desalination cost is also coming down quite rapidly to towards less than $1 cubic meters. Just for the producing desal waters now that are coming down to almost half a dollar cubic meter. That's very much comparable to conventional water supply pricing. Yeah, so it's very unique challenge, but also there's a lot of opportunity that country can work on.
Right, right. And I was impressed that Saudi Arabia is looking at, is doing a lot of desalination, but is also looking at wastewater reuse, because you've got the energy to treat that wastewater. And so, and much of that treated wastewater then is used for irrigation and then stormwater capture. I often saw these conferences on rainwater harvesting, but I think under the umbrella of rainwater harvesting, they're talking about stormwater capture and maybe creating dams, small dams along the rivers to hold the water back from intense events so that it is an opportunity to recharge maybe some of the shallow aquifers. In all of these things, then a portfolio of options being considered And you are fortunate then that you have the energy and the economy to support the investments in these things early on, and then that hopefully there will be a good return. And the hydrogen, and so I guess ammonia is more stable than hydrogen, so you wouldn't actually be shipping the hydrogen itself, but shipping it in the form of ammonia, and then it'd be converted back to hydrogen in Japan. So that is really interesting. So it seems you are developing a resilient system then, with a portfolio of options for water and energy and moving towards net zero in the future.
Yes, and if I give an overview of the water consumption in Saudi Arabia, so it's about 80% coming from the fossil groundwater. That's mainly for agriculture. Then 10% coming from the desalinations, but this is where the large expansion is expected for next several years. So desalination capacity going to be more than double next several years in Saudi Arabia. Then wastewater reuse is also getting a lot of traction, especially in the major cities. In Saudi Arabia, by 2030, 80% of the treated wastewater will be reused in all the major cities in Saudi Arabia. That's a big target, but it's very, very important and potential water supply. And stormwater capture is, so it's very dry country, but we do have rain events in the wet period, which is now, it's starting. We had quite an intense rain last week, and we could capture up to potentially a few cubic kilometers. That's quite a big body of the water. And we do have already almost 600 reservoirs in the countries, and we're planning additional 1,000 reservoirs in Saudi Arabia. And we also want to do manage aquifer recharge using those stormwater captures. So yeah, having very harsh environment, but also there's an opportunity that potentially we can utilize. And so we try to harvest those potential. Yeah.
It's impressive, all of the different things that you are doing and trying to optimize and take advantage. But do you have the advantage of having cheap energy? And so that helps. And then it helps kickstart new stuff with the investments in renewable and all of those sorts of things. And you said 50 cents a cubic meter for desalinated water. That's amazing. And then you also mentioned, Yoshi, that you're working on ecosystem aspects and the sustainability of those. And so when you consider a lot of these desalination plants, you are fortunate Saudi Arabia, you have access to the Red Sea and then the Persian Gulf also. And so you can desalinate water from both regions. But then the concentrator, which is about twice, if you have 50% efficiency in your desal, then the concentrate that goes back then is about twice that of the seawater that you are desalinating. And so dealing with that concentration, considering you mentioned coral reefs in the Red Sea and trying to maintain those for the resorts that are being planned along the Red Sea, maybe you can describe that a little bit, Yoshi.
Yes, so country also are aiming to increase substantially the international tourist. That's expected to support also economic diversifications and national revenues. And currently, Saudi Arabia is receiving about 25 million international tourists. Goal is that increase this to about 70 million by 2030. And to support this, country also constructing a lot of resort areas along the Red Seas and also the Neon. And another area is called Arura. Arura is a middle of the Saudi Arabia where the country building sort of a tourist areas with the natures and restored ecosystems. Yeah, some large infrastructure to accommodate the tourists. And this is a big pillar for the countries. And important things also Saudi Arabia is that while we aiming for net zero by 2060, there's still a little bit of gaps that we have to fill. Even though those renewable and the new technology is coming, we still have to fill the gap. And country, in order to respond to this, also planting many trees to sequestrate the carbon as well. And this is called the Saudi Green Initiative. And we're planting 10 billion trees in the country. And this is another pillars that also supporting transformations. However, all those infrastructure, resort areas, and the desalinations and the concern, and also actually for the coral reef in the Red Sea areas due to high salinities, that you do see quite some impact. And we do have to do much more investigations that what's the direct impact having much larger desalination capacity in the Red Sea and the impact on the coral reef and marine ecosystem. That's not exactly clear causal effect between those. So my team is actually investigating into it. Because Red Sea has like higher salinity in general compared to other seas. And recently also a temperature extreme happening in the oceans, not just the surface, but in the ocean as well. So it's called marine heat waves. That's also happening in the Red Sea, affecting ecosystem. The heat is also going up in the land and also the ocean both, affecting the ecosystems. And that's an important event that we have to understand.
Right. And you mentioned this project, Aurora. I was trying to find out some information, but I didn't know how to spell it. So I couldn't actually find it. But anyway, and maybe trying to restore some oases or something. Is that another initiative? And then you mentioned that the camel population, I don't know how many camels you have in Saudi Arabia, and that they all have their own IDs, which I thought was fascinating. So you know where they're going.
Yes, so Saudi Arabia, so population is about 32 million, and we have also more than 30 million camels, and we have also more than 30 million date palm tree as well.
Very interesting. And so, Yoshi, you joined KAUST a couple of years ago. Maybe you can describe a little bit about the university, the students, and the support, and the demography of the students and of your team there. It would be very interesting.
Yes, it's still a very new university, which has history of about 15 years. And this was established by the King Abdullah, former king of the Saudi Arabia. Idea is that to establish a leading scientific institute from the Middle East in Saudi Arabia, focusing on science, technology, benefiting society and the economies and people's well-being. And KAUST is very diverse community, so we have about 120 nationalities from all over the world. My team, I have about 30 staff and with 12 nationalities from different regions and continents. And we have very good package for the students, so we're providing free housings, very good housing facilities, and also very good scholarship. So basically, students can really focus on the study and the research, like a master and the PhDs. So we are the graduate university, so we don't have undergraduate. And we have three divisions, biology, environmental science, and also earth science, then also computer, electric science. So we have three divisions, very much focusing on science, technology side. And recently, we have also quite some startup happening from the universities.
And where are you located, Yoshi? Are you in Riyadh? Or?
Yeah, so this is also another maybe unique feature of the university. We are located just next to the Red Sea. It's called Tuwal, and it's about 1 hour away from Jeddah by car.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And then also Saudi Arabia, they supported the students going overseas, right? And spending time in the US and Europe and many China and other regions. So that's really great. So they got an opportunity to see what's happening and to improve communication. I saw this also in Brazil. They were supporting the students spending a year overseas in their graduate work and really helps network and everything. So, and then I guess they don't have fees to pay and their housing is covered. That's amazing. So that really relieves a lot of pressure on students these days. So I really appreciate your time and describing the situation over there. It's fascinating. And it's a kind of one end member of what I think about when you have a lot of energy, how you can use that to help with the water and the food situation and security. But then seeing how Saudi Arabia is evolving, it's really fascinating. So are there many electric cars over there, Yoshi, or what is that situation like? Are you driving an electric car these days? Are you driving a Tesla?
I would say it's increasing. And one of my colleagues actually just bought Tesla. So yeah, country also shifting EVs and supporting company called Lucid. Mm-hmm. And we have factory actually nearby university as well.
You're covering all your bases. But I think what's impressive, Yoshi, and you mentioned early on that you're going into a systems approach to understand the trade-offs and to help the decision makers and the policy makers as they move forward so that they consider all of the different aspects, water, energy, and food, transportation, and all of these different things. So thank you so much for your time and good luck with your work there, and I look forward to seeing your upcoming work and learning more in the future.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunities, and looking forward to providing you more update later.